Donald Trump delivers a message to global economic leaders.
Under the Trump administration, there will be no better place on earth to create jobs, build factories, or grow a company.
And Trump's America First becomes the new U.S. foreign policy.
And that mission is to ensure that our foreign policy is centered on one thing, and that is the advancement of our national interests, which they have clearly defined through his campaign as anything that makes us stronger, or safer, or more prosperous. And that will be our mission.
Join us on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London with Scott Walterman in Washington.
Under our leadership, America is back and open for business.
Speaking remotely from the White House, President Donald Trump delivered his first major global speech to global business and political leaders, meeting at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
Under the Trump administration, there will be no better place on earth to create jobs, build factories, or grow a company than right here in the good old USA.
He gave an incentive and a warning.
My message to every business in the world is very simple. Come make your product in America, and we will give you among the lowest taxes of any nation on earth. We're bringing them down very substantially, even from the original Trump tax cuts. But if you don't make your product in America, which is your prerogative, then very simply, you will have to pay a tariff.
And he also had a message for oil-producing nations.
And I'm also going to ask Saudi Arabia and OPEC to bring down the cost of oil. You got to bring it down, which, frankly, I'm surprised they didn't do before the election. That didn't show a lot of love by them not doing it. I was a little surprised by that. If the price came down, the Russia-Ukraine war would end immediately.
Well, let's get some perspective from an economist's point of view. Joining us to talk more about that is David Kass. He is a clinical professor of finance at the University of Maryland Robert H. Smith School of Business. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
You're very welcome.
What was your general perspective on President Trump's first major speech to a global community when it comes to economics?
Well, I thought he was certainly very upbeat and encouraging other countries or companies in other countries to invest in the United States. There will be several regulatory advantages. For example, he mentioned a lower corporate income tax rate of just 15%. Right now, the corporate income tax in the U.S. For American companies is a statutory rate is 21%, which was reduced from 35% in 2017 when President Trump's first term. So he would even give preferential tax treatment to companies, foreign companies investing in the United States. So he was certainly trying to reach out in that regard. He was somewhat critical of the European regulatory structure with respect to the large tech companies, having singled them out for multi-billion dollar fines and, along the lines of antitrust. And indeed, it would appear that the European regulatory apparatus with respect to antitrust is very aggressive with respect to the U.S. Tech companies. So I think he made an interesting point there. And in saying that, perhaps encouraging the European regulatory authorities in the near future to be less draconian in their decisions or analyses of various commercial arrangements from the large U.S. tech companies. But he certainly expresses dissatisfaction in that regard. And I think certainly the U.S. tech companies would share that those feelings. So it sounded like he would certainly like to improve relations with Europe. He was critical of various value-added tax arrangements in Europe with respect to U.S. companies. He said something to the effect that U.S. autos, auto companies can't sell their cars in Europe, but Europe can sell them here. Something to that effect. So being somewhat critical of some trade barriers, relative trade barriers in Europe relative to the U.S. I'm sure he's saying that in the sense of trying to improve future trade relationships between the U.S. and Europe, and perhaps his prior mention of potential tariffs that would apply to Europe as well as China and other countries could be used and are being used in a context of negotiation threat. I don't know what will be implemented in the future, but I think he is somewhat concerned of leveling the playing field from his point of view in terms of international trade between the U.S. and Europe.
That was the give and take between come here and make your stuff, I'll give you a tax break. Don't come here and make your stuff, and I'll tariff you.
Yes, that was pretty much exactly the message that he did communicate. And I think that was indeed pretty clear, and certainly encouraging as much investment in the U.S. as possible. But certainly there was sort of a carrot and stick message being sent. We'll give you the carrot benefits. You come here, you get a lower tax rate. And the stick part, if you don't come here, you just produce over there and then try to send it to the U.S., there'll be tariffs that'll be imposed on you. So both incentives and disincentives, let's say, being suggested.
There had been a lot of debate over the tariff issue that he has talked about. Economically, from an economic perspective, if countries don't or for whatever reason aren't able to make their products in America for whatever reason, and they do have to pay tariffs, what are the potential economic impacts on the U.S.? Will we take in more money? Will our prices go up? Because we've heard a lot of debate about that.
Yes. First of all, it certainly would depend on the magnitude of the tariffs. As percentage increases, I think 3% was the average tariff implemented during Trump's first administration, and now talk of 10 to 25%, something in that range being discussed now, the magnitude much higher and the consequences much greater. Certainly, to the extent that tariffs are actually implemented, it's certainly a source of revenue for the Treasury, but it also will lead to higher prices. It should result and will result in inflation, and there could one could reasonably expect some retaliation on the other side, as from European countries or countries directly affected by the U.S. tariffs. And President Trump has made the comment that he wants to lower income taxes and offset the loss of revenue with tariffs, but he may be able to do that, but the tariffs in effect would be a form of sales tax. You may be reducing an income tax, but increasing a sales tax. And indeed, the sales tax part would probably be somewhat regressive, that those with lower income might be affected to a larger extent by an increase in prices resulting from tariffs. Most economists, not all, but most overwhelming majority of economists would agree with what I've just said, that tariffs would very likely lead to inflation and slower economic growth as a result of the higher prices coming from it. So it depends on the magnitude. On the magnitude of the tariffs, the extent that it's implemented. Again, if it's done on a very low level and it's targeted in a couple of areas, targeted industries that may be, let's say, unfriendly to U.S. exports, it could have some positive impact. And certainly there are more revenues being raised by them. But I think most economists would discourage their general use or use at a fairly high level.
Is there a long-term benefit to tariffs?
It discourages international trade, which economists are all taught the benefits of international trade, comparative advantage. Certain countries can provide labor at lower rates, others manufacturing technology. For instance, the U.S. is very strong in technology. Certain countries in Asia could provide provide lower cost labor. But long term, you don't really have much to go on except the 1930s. The Smoot-Hawley tariffs in the 1930s, most economic historians agree that it contributed to and extended the degree of the Great Depression of the 1930s. It does reduce trade. And I believe over time, consumers and countries would be worse off.
Turning to another topic that he brought up, which was oil production, he said he plans to ask Saudi Arabia and the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries to cut the price of oil they produce to boost the global economy. Is that something that is possible?
Yes, I agree with his comment that it's the oil-producing countries that are restricting supply and determining the price. I mean, this is OPEC really came on the scene, so to speak, in 1973 with the so-called Arab oil embargo of 1973. There was the Middle East War, and the price of oil quadrupled overnight in 1973, then doubled again in 1979. And these are countries restricting supply, and prices are determined by supply and demand. And I think President Trump is correct that encouraging Middle East countries to produce more oil would result in lower prices, and that would actually be stimulative, in my opinion, to the world economy.
Davos has really got two primary attendees, the wealthy and nation states. The wealthy seemed really, really happy with his remarks and where he was taking the U.S.
Now, certainly, the U.S. economy, let's say, is doing very well right now. The financial markets are all pretty close to all-time highs. GDP is at a healthy growth rate, 2 to 3%. Unemployment is near historically low levels at 4.1%, close to lowest levels in 50 years. The U.S. economy is actually leading the world, and there's no sign of a recession in sight. So I think President Trump has actually inherited a very strong economy, and certainly I'm sure would like to continue having the economy remain strong and grow faster. And yes, in terms of the wealthy benefiting from it, certainly those who have the wherewithal to invest have financial assets. Financial assets are certainly growing and would provide a very healthy environment for business and investment.
We really appreciate your taking the time to explain all of this, and thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
David Kass, clinical professor of finance at the University of Maryland, Robert H. Smith School of Business.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London with Scott Walterman.
My sincerest hope and my prayer is that we will, as a nation, be able to leave the future generations with a country and a planet safer and better than the one that was left for us.
America's new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, spells out his foreign policy priorities that will be at the heart of American diplomacy.
In our republic, the voters decide the course of our nation, both domestically and abroad, and they have elected Donald J. Trump as our president when it comes to foreign policy on a very clear mission. And that mission is to ensure that our foreign policy is centered on one thing, and that is the advancement of our national interest.
So the question now is, how much change will there be in the new administration's vision for America's foreign policy? Joining us now for some perspective is Daniel Hamilton. He is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center on the United States in Europe.
Thank you so much for being able to talk to us about this.
Glad to be here.
New administration, new Secretary of State, new priorities, new mission. Secretary Rubio put out a statement and said everything we do is going to be judged by these three directives from the president. Does it make America safer? Does it make America stronger? And does it make America more prosperous?
Well, I think if you look at what the secretary has said in just the day or so he's been in office, but I think the underlying message is that he has said that for 70 years, the United States thought preservation of what he called the liberal world order was the main goal of U.S. foreign policy, and that while there were some successes there, it was a triumphalist feeling that that was what we still needed to do. And in the meantime, according to him and to the president, U.S. efforts to do so have left Americans exhausted, poorer. We've lost the industrial capacity of the country. We created dependencies on other countries, all at the time when other countries have been pursuing their national interests and have not joined in that same defense of the world order, and many of them trying to abuse it. So his conclusion is, back to those three points you mentioned, the U.S. will focus on pure national interests as defined in those three ways. You know, you can argue whether preservation of a structure at which the U.S. leads the world is also a U.S. interest, and hasn't that, in fact, brought the end of the Cold War and help us have alliances around the world? That's, I think, part of the debate here in the United States.
One of the things he also stated in an actual statement that he put out was that we must stop censorship and suppression of information.
He has said a number of things like that. One, the first point that you mentioned is, again, free speech, meaning no guidelines on how media platforms should conduct themselves, no restrictions on free speech. It has to do a lot with our domestic debate, frankly, right now about curbs on social media. Are they fact-checking what they put out there on platforms? So a lot of it is, frankly, is a domestically oriented statement, but it has to do, they shut down the office that Secretary Blinken had set up about checking, you know, facts and disinformation from other countries, that it was doing a lot of work on Russia and China, for instance. They shut that down already. So I think it's a statement that there's just going to be no controls on that, or no sort of double checking and setting up any types of guidelines. I think the other couple points that the Secretary made in that same context was, he said the priorities will be put an end to mass migration, secure the borders. He said the U.S. will not engage anymore in sort of the diversity, equity, inclusion agenda, and directed the department to go scour its own rules and procedures so it doesn't do that. I think that's quite controversial. He said we will not engage in any sort of what he thought was, or I think, I don't want to misphrase him, but say tangential cultural issues that divert us from those three goals that we mentioned earlier. That has huge implications for how the U.S. is engaged in cultural programming around the world. And then he said, you know, we're going to abandon the earlier climate goals of Biden administration and others. The president's already said we'd step away from the global climate talks. And Secretary Rubio, you know, doubled down on saying the goal is actually to achieve what he called energy dominance. So to put the U.S. in the position of really being a major energy player in the world, if not the dominant one. Those are the main things he said that are important. Also interesting what he didn't say. He hasn't said much about managing relations with allies or adversaries. He did say the first meeting he's having was with the Pacific Quad, so he did go that far, but he has had some media interviews where he hasn't really discussed too much in detail how you talk about managing conflicts or bringing them to an end in Europe and in the Middle East. He said a bit about Ukraine, only saying all sides have suffered and we have to put an end to the war, but he hasn't said how that actually will happen.
A lot of the things that you talked about, ending DEI inside the department, energy dominance, not really attending to global warming. These are administration-wide policies. It's not just state. It's just that he's the first cabinet member to be confirmed. But I think right, you're going to see that those same themes roll out across every single department in the government. But since this is state and it's the relationship holder with the rest of the world, how does that push out to other countries, allies, and foes?
Well, we'll have to see, because as you say, you know, much of America's relations with the world is not just through the State Department. It's all, every agency in the U.S. government has some sort of international linkage. What was interesting that Secretary said was to his own new employees is the State Department sometimes been, he said, relegated to secondary roles because other agencies have been more agile or, you know, quicker on their feet. I can only assume he might meet the intelligence community or the defense community Deputy or the trade officials. Those all have, you know, major, of course, foreign entanglements as well. So we'll see how Marco Rubio stands up in the interagency debates in the United States about, you know, all these kinds of Trump-induced directives. The other thing, he might be the first member of the cabinet to start his job, but he really has no team. They have a whole bunch of seconded senior officials sort of keeping seats warm, but there's no one behind him at the moment. And, you know, in the United States, I think it's always important for people to realize almost always the presidential transition when you get senior officials into the government. You know, we switch out the top 4,000 to 6,000 people in the federal government when any new president comes into office. And it usually takes 6 to 8 months before, you know, the real full team is in place. And when it comes to the State Department, ambassadors have to be confirmed. Any senior level official have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And that delays things a lot. I don't think this is going to be a, you know, quick burst of energy here, because you'll find easily the day-to-day diplomacy is still being run by senior professionals in the Foreign Service.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about one of the things that the Secretary said. He talked about returning to the basics of diplomacy by eliminating focus on political and specifically, you said, cultural causes.
Yes.
And you said that that would have broad implications. I'm wondering what those implications would be in your view.
Well, again, it's hard to know what he meant. That was, you know, one line in a speech. But the State Department engages in cultural diplomacy everywhere in the world. Major information channels, you know, cultural programming. Lots of U.S. cultural groups go out around the world. We work with the State Department to when everything you can think about, arts and culture, they're all over everywhere. That's putting America's face forward in terms of the society that we are. So it's hard to know what of those elements he considered, I think, as he said, tangential to the core mission. Does cultural programming make America stronger? Does it make it safer? Does it make it more prosperous? Those are his benchmarks. So I think cultural programmers in the State Department will have to answer the question there. Yes, it does make us stronger by showing the diversity and the vibrancy of our society. It makes us safer by other countries getting to know us better and understanding, you know, what's important to the United States. Does it make us more prosperous? Well, the U.S. cultural industry, if you will, is probably the leading one in the world compared to others. So I think they can answer that question, but they'll be under pressure to show that.
We talked to somebody recently who said the world is changing, and you mentioned it in the very beginning, this type of big machine diplomacy and alliance is changing, that Europe is becoming a non-player, China is emerging, the global south is emerging, and that in the future, global diplomacy is going to be a more transactional affair. Do you see that or agree with that or disagree with that?
Well, I think many commentators have said Donald Trump is a transactional type of individual and that his policies are quite transactional when it comes to other countries around the world. I think that's what surprised so many allies, that it seems to be a more transactional than values-based types of relationship. I haven't heard him since he's become president again or Secretary Rubio use those words, so it's hard to, you know, ascribe it to them, but as I say, I think the thrust of it that both of them are saying is that the U.S., by upholding the liberal order, as they called it, sacrificed unduly. And I think even Secretary Rubio in his confirmation hearing said, you know, we were cheated and they stole things from us. So this is kind of a, you know, an angry type of tone about other countries. And they don't distinguish too much between allies or adversaries. It'll come down to real policies. For instance, tariffs. President Trump wants to impose tariffs. He said that a lot. It's coming, he says. We shall see. Well, tariffs will influence foreign policy. And the question is whether the State Department was going to drive that policy or whether it'll be the White House itself or the U.S. Trade Representative's office. Back to the interagency fights that are certain to come about who is really setting the direction of these types of policies. I'm not sure the State Department will be in the lead on that type of effort. because it's driven really from the White House. I'm not sure the State Department will be in the lead when it comes to trying to bring the war against Ukraine to an end, because there's a special envoy that's reporting directly to the president. I'm not sure the State Department is going to lead on a whole range of issues that are traditionally foreign policy, but which the White House itself is going to direct. So, you know, this is the Trump foreign policy. It's not the Rubio foreign policy. The Secretary has said that, but I think one needs to find where will the State Department really play the decisive role, and I think that's still very much up for grabs.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Really informative. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Daniel S. Hamilton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center on the United States and Europe.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of Scott and all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to our daily podcast, The Issue. It's available at voanews.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.